वर्ड फॉर वर्ड ट्रांसलेशन. श्री नंद उवाच. नंद महाराज सेड, अहो अलास, ते योर देवकी पुत्रः. ऑल द सन्स ऑफ योर वाइफ देवकी. कंसेन, बाय किंग कंस. बहवः, मेनी. हतः, हैव बीन किल्ड. एका, वन. अवशिष्टा, रिमेनिंग चाइल्ड. अवरजा, द यंगेस्ट ऑफ ऑल. कन्या, अ डॉटर ऑल्सो. सा अपि, शी ऑल्सो. दिवं गता, गॉन टू द हेवनली प्लैनेट्स. ट्रांसलेशन परपोर्ट बाय हिज डिवाइन ग्रेस एसी भक्तिवेदांत स्वामी श्रील प्रभुपाद. जय श्री प्रभुपाद. ट्रांसलेशन. नंद महाराज सेड, अलास, किंग कंसा किल्ड सो मेनी ऑफ योर चिल्ड्रन बॉर्न ऑफ देवकी एंड योर वन डॉटर द यंगेस्ट चाइल्ड ऑफ ऑल entered the heavenly planets. Purport. When Vasudeva understood from Nanda Maharaj that the mystery of Krishna's birth and his having been exchanged with Yashoda's daughter was yet undisclosed, he was happy that things were going on nicely. By saying that Vasudeva's daughter, his youngest child, had gone to the heavenly planets, Nanda Maharaj indicated that he did not know that this daughter was born of Yashoda and that Vasudeva had exchanged her with Krishna. Thus the doubts of Vasudeva were dispelled. Om Ajnana Timirandhasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prishthaya Bhutale Shrimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Iti Namine. नमस्ते सरस्वती देवे गौरवाणी प्रचारिणे निर्विशेष शून्यवादी पाश्चात्य देश तारिणे वांछाकल्पतरुभ्यश्च कृपासिंधुभ्य एव च पतितानां पावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः. जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभो नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधार श्रीवासादि गौर भक्तवृंद. हरे कृष्णा 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 हरे हरे. हरे राम 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 हरे हरे. हरे कृष्णा. So I seek the blessings of all the senior Vaishnavas so that I can speak on the Srimad Bhagavatam. So today morning, the Bhagavatam is narrating the subsequent events after the dramatic birth of Krishna. Up appearance of Krishna in this world. Nanda Maharaj, without his knowledge, had his progeny exchanged by Vasudev. When Vasudev came in the middle of the night through the Yamuna and delivered his son there. And then he came back and he brought the daughter which Yashoda had begotten back over here to Mathura, into the prison. Now, in the Bhagavatam, there is an intriguing, both revealing and concealing of Krishna's divinity for the Vrajavasis. Nanda Maharaj, I'll just go a little forward and then I'll come back. When Krishna comes back to Vrindavan later, and then he kills Kamsa, and then the Yadus say, you must stay here. You are the person, you are the Ashtam Garbha, you were the person who were prophesied to kill Kamsa. And thus, you are actually Vasudev's son, and therefore you should come and stay here. So, at that time, Krishna goes back and tells his father, Vasudev, who has also come to Mathura, he says that based on their prediction, they are saying that I am their son. And therefore, they want me to stay here. So actually, Nanda Maharaj is shattered at that time. He is angry actually. Sometimes he just can't bear the thought of separation from Krishna. And not to speak of separation from an indefinite period of time. Because the Yadus were saying that Kamsa has been killed, but Kamsa had many allies. And those allies would now attack. And not only the allies would attack in order to avenge Kamsa's death, but also Kamsa had made many enemies. Kamsa had plundered the wealth of many kingdoms. So those people would now think that maybe Mathura is weak and we can attack now. So we are in danger and you need to protect us. So Nanda Maharaj at that time felt that he just started laughing. Sometimes, we have to laugh to stop from crying. So it was like that for Nanda Maharaj. And he said, oh, it is our fortune that the son who is ours is being claimed by great people. So comparatively speaking in the hierarchy, Nanda Maharaj was the leader of a cowherd village, whereas Vasudev was the king. So Nanda Maharaj said that it's our fortune that Vasudev is claiming my son to be his son. But he said he himself acknowledged that actually you are my son. In the same chapter, if we go back earlier, Vasudev tells Nanda Maharaj that, oh, although you are very advanced in age, and usually at this age, it is difficult to have children. But because of your prolonged austerity and because of the mercy of God, you have got a child. You got a son. That is a great fortune. So Vasudev, Nanda Maharaj quotes this and he says, Nanda Maharaj, Vasudev acknowledged that you are my son. He says, I have begotten you. And just now, see the will of destiny that he is now claiming you to be his son. So actually, does Nanda Maharaj and do the Vrajavasis know that Krishna is their son? Or that Krishna is actually Vasudev's son? So there is very intriguing, as I said, concealing and revealing. So from the point of view of the way they celebrate after Krishna's birth, it is Krishna is their own son. Nanda Maharaj gives so much charity, is so delighted. And then Gargacharya comes there. Now when Gargacharya comes there, he is the son of... So Gargacharya is the priest of the Yadu dynasty. Now the Yadu dynasty and the dynasty of Nanda Maharaj, they are related. They were sons of... In the same dynasty, they were slightly different branches. So they are related. But... They're not exactly brothers. They are, we could say that they are, because they're in different varnas, so their social position is slightly different. So now what happens here is that Nanda Maharaj sees it as a great fortune that Garacharya has come. He said, now we have to do the Namakaran, we have to do the name giving ceremony of this child, and therefore we will, therefore, it's fortune that you have come here. Now, in one sense, Gargacharya has come there because Krishna is the son of Vasudev. And the sons born in the Yadu family, it is a tradition that he will give them their names. So now, from some reading of the narratives, it appears as if Nanda Maharaj also knows that Krishna is the son of Vasudev, and therefore he agrees that let there be a low profile namakaran ceremony, name giving ceremony. Because if there is a high profile ceremony, if we invite a lot of people and everybody comes to know about it, then if Kamsa comes to know and he sees that the priest of the Yadu dynasty has performed this name giving ceremony, he will think that actually this must be the son of Vasudev. And therefore, he will suspect like that and he will try to kill this child. So, this narration, one reading of it can be that actually Nanda Maharaj knows that he is Vasudev's son, and therefore he wants Gargacharya to do the ceremony, and along with that, he also wants to keep it concealed. So for the protection of Krishna. But another reading of it is that actually Kamsa had gone on a rampage of killing all newborn children at that time. That's how Putana had also come there. So, Nanda Maharaj was just playing safe. Nanda Maharaj was just wanting to avoid any suspicion. So, because he was killing all small children born in that time, so he thought, let him not come to know that the child has been born. Let us not do a very high profile ceremony. And that's why Krishna's name giving ceremony happened in a cowshed. It was in its own way opulent, but not like a jubilant big celebration. Now, Srila Jiva Goswami, in his Gopal Champu, takes the second reading. He says, Nanda Maharaj never knows that Krishna is not my son. Right from the beginning, he always thinks Krishna is my son. And he thinks that, okay, Vasudev has taken my son. And he feels very aggrieved by that. Later on, even when Balram gets married, so after that, Krishna's marriage is to take place. When Balram gets married, and at that time, the news goes to Vrindavan. And when he hears this, he's happy. Oh, now Balram has got married. That's a natural desire of parents, that their children get married and settle down. But the first question he gets on hearing this is, you know, whom will Krishna marry? If Krishna marries a Kshatriya girl, then that means he is acknowledging to the world that he is a Kshatriya. But if Krishna comes back to Vrindavan and marries a Vaishya girl, then he will be acknowledging that I am his father, that he is my son. So actually in Gopal Champu, till the end, actually Nanda Maharaj never acknowledges that Krishna is the son of Vasudev. He says, Krishna is my son only. And actually, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur elaborates on this reading by telling that Krishna manifests in multiple forms. So there is, when Nanda Maharaj gives birth, actually it's not just one Krishna who is born. It is Krishna, it is a male and a female child, both of them are born together. And that Krishna is called as Vrindavan Krishna, Anandanandan Krishna. And then the Krishna that is born in Mathura, that is Vasudev Krishna. And when Krishna when Vasudev brings Vasudev Krishna, his son, across the Jamuna, it's dark. And because of darkness, he doesn't see what is happening over there. And not seeing what is happening means, he doesn't see actually there are two children over there. So he just sees one child over there, sees it's a girl. So he picks up the girl and he puts there the boy. And then the Vasudev Krishna and the Vrindavan Krishna, they join into one. They become one. And then this Krishna is the Krishna who is present in Vrindavan performing Leela. And then, actually another explanation that is given is that when Vasudev is taking Krishna across the Jamuna to take him to Vrindavan, at that time Krishna falls into the Jamuna. Now he's carrying in a box. And he's carrying in a box, suddenly Krishna falls off. and falls off, and he falls into the river, and the river is, you know, it's a stormy river. So there is panicky. You know, this is the son for whom he has performed so much. He has gone through so much suffering. He has seen the death of 7 of his children. And, you know, the death of any child is very painful for parents. And all the more so when the parents find that they are helpless to stop that death. And if it happens by natural causes beyond human power, then that also is suffering. But when it happens in front of your one's eyes with some other person, more powerful person coming and killing the child, it is not just the loss of a child, it is also becomes a statement of one's own inability to protect one's children, one's dependents. So Kamsa had Vasudeva had gone through all this, and now suddenly he found that this 8th son has fallen to the river, panicking, he said, groping here, groping there, couldn't find the son anywhere. And finally, to his relief, he saw a small head bobbing up out of the water. At this time, Krishna is bare, not even, it's just a baby. You know, if you see a newborn child, it's not even the length of a palm sometimes, very, very small. So he's amazed, how has Krishna lived? And he runs there, he moves to the water, goes there, and he picks up Krishna. So, according to some readings, it is that at this time, when Krishna falls off, so that Vasudeva Krishna falls into the Yamuna, but what he picks up is Vrindavan Krishna. So the Krishna who enters into Vrindavan is Vrindavan Krishna. And later on in the 40th chapter of the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, when it is described that that Akrura comes and takes Krishna back to Vrindavan, at that time to Mathura, at that time, Krishna says, I want to take a bath in the Yamuna. And when he takes a bath in the Yamuna, at that time, Vrindavan Krishna goes into the Yamuna to take bath, but Vasudeva Krishna comes out. And as in Vrindavan Parityajya Padam Ekam Nagachati, the Puranas say that Krishna never leaves Vrindavan. He never takes even one step out of Vrindavan. That's his immense love for Vrindavan. And this statement, how it is true, is revealed through these later narrations of how there are two manifestations of Krishna. And Vrindavan Krishna never leaves Vrindavan. Now, significantly, however, although Vrindavan Krishna never leaves Vrindavan, he is not visible to the Vrajavasis when he is there. So that's why the Vrajavasis feel separation from Krishna. The Vrajavasis feel immense separation from Krishna because they think Krishna is not there. Vrindavan Krishna exists in an unmanifested form. And he, wherever the devotees, they're longing for Krishna, and they long for his association, they intensely remember him. So, it is this Vrindavan Krishna that manifests in their hearts, and to some extent mitigates their feelings of separation. So Vrindavan Krishna is here in Vrindavan, whereas the Vasudeva Krishna goes back to Mathura. So at this point, actually, in the narrative, Vasudeva's concern is has the secret been still maintained? So, there are various levels at which secrets can be maintained. You know, they say that, you know, the best way to keep a secret is to not tell it to anyone. If you tell it to one person, and quite often for most people, if you tell them a secret, and tell them this is a secret, don't tell anyone. What they will do? They will tell to a third person and say, this is a secret, don't tell anyone. And they will tell to a fourth person, this is a secret, don't tell anyone. So that way, that secret which is supposed to be a secret, everybody says it's a secret, but it becomes a public knowledge. So at this point, Vasudeva is concerned, has the secret come out? So he is concerned, has Vasudeva come to know about it? So the previous statement of Vasudeva, where Vasudeva says that, the previous statement is, this statement, Kanya cha sapi divam gata. Oh, your daughter, she went to the heavens. So when Kamsa, he saw this 8th child, it was a daughter. He was taken aback. He says, Ashtam garbha. Then he remembered that it was the 8th child that will kill. The specific reference, Sanatana Goswami has written his Vaishnava Toshanitika on this Bhagavatam, and on the 10th canto of Bhagavatam. And therein he explains that actually the word that is used is gender neutral. Ashtam garbha. It is not when it is said in the Akashvani, when the prediction comes that Kamsa's, that Vasudeva's 8th child will kill Kamsa, then it is a gender neutral. It is not Ashtam Putra, it is Ashtam Garbha. So now it was thought that the person who would kill Kamsa would be a male. So everybody had assumed that the eighth child would be a male child. So when Kamsa saw that this eighth child was a female, he was taken aback. What has happened? You know, sometimes people ask this question that, you know, if Kamsa knew that the eighth child of Devaki was going to kill him, and if he didn't want to die, he could just have kept Vasudeva and Devaki in separate chambers. You know, if he had never allowed them to stay together, then he would never have got a child, and then he would not have had the problem. So Kamsa, you know, he was a demon. And demon means that not only was he attached to protecting his own life, the purpose of his life was to disrupt cosmic order. He thought, I am more powerful than the cosmic order. And that's how he had attacked the gods, and he had defeated the gods, and he had overpowered them. And now he thought, when Vasudeva did all his special pleading, you know, let him live. I will give all the son, let her live. I will give all the children from her to you. So at that time, Kamsa agreed for multiple reasons. One of the reasons was that he thought that I will prove the gods' words to be wrong. That let the eighth child be born. The gods have predicted that the eighth child will kill me. But instead of the eighth child killing me, let the eighth child be born, then I'll kill him. And in this way, I will prove to the world how powerful I am. That I can prove the God's words to be false. The Akashvani that has come, I'll prove it to be false. So he saw that as a challenge in his demoniac mentality. And that's how, when actually the eighth child is born, he said, this is a girl. He doesn't know what to do at that time. Should I kill her or should I let her live? And then he thinks, no, better play safe. Takes the girl and decides to kill her. And he catches her and is about to bash her on the ground the way he has bashed all the previous children. The girl suddenly slips out of his hands. It slips out of his hands and goes into the air and manifests herself as Durga. And when she manifests herself as Durga, he's taken aback and she laughs and he says, this fool, the child whom he was going to kill you, he's already born elsewhere. And he disappears on saying this. Now Kamsa was at that time a worshipper of the devatas. So he would also worship, he would worship Shiva, and he worshipped his goddess also. So he felt, oh, this goddess has appeared from Devaki's womb. So he has multiple reactions. First reaction is, he thinks, actually, even the gods lie. The gods had said that the Akashvani, the celestials had said that the eighth son will kill me. But actually the eighth child is a boy, and that boy was actually not, the eighth child is a girl, and that girl is the goddess. So who's going to kill me? He first thinks that, oh, the gods have lied. And this whole thing was just a hoax. There's no one going to kill me. But then he starts thinking that actually, if the goddess was born through Devaki, Devaki must be a very special person. And further he thinks that if the gods have lied, then what have I done by killing the previous children of Devaki? And thus thinking like this, he laments. And he laments and actually seeks forgiveness from Vasudeva and Devaki. And does, you know, please forgive me, please forgive me. And then he says that actually it is not my fault. You should not blame me that your sons have been killed. It is the will of destiny because of which they were killed. So now I'll focus a little bit on this theme of destiny. The idea of destiny is sometimes very revolting to modern human consciousness. Modern consciousness, if it is characterized by anything, it is characterized by the drive for self-determination. Self-determination means I can do whatever I want. No. If I want to climb up a mountain, I can climb a mountain. If I want to make a big building, I can make a big building. If whatever I want to do, if I set my mind to it, I will do it. That is the modern idea. But even within this idea, so much of modern humanity, modern and postmodern humanity has done much which which in the previous generations, at least in the recent past, might have been thought impossible. And people say this is the proof that if humanity sets their mind on whatever they want to do, they will be able to do it. But still, there are undeniable limitations. Now, a person who is, say, tone deaf, no matter what they do, that person cannot become the next Mozart. So there are limitations created by destiny. And this idea that if I claim that I am the determiner of I can do whatever I want, then if I am responsible for my success, if I alone am responsible for my success, then I alone become responsible for my failure. And in a hyper-competitive world, you know, everybody cannot be at the top. So people, the society often imposes a particular definition of success on everyone. You know, as a student, you have to be a topper. As a professional, you have to have this level of opulence, this kind of car, this kind of house, then you are successful, otherwise you are not. Now, not everyone can achieve that. And to the extent we take credit that I achieved this by my efforts, then if I can't achieve something, then that inability becomes not an event, that inability becomes a statement about yourself, about the person. Oh, you are good for nothing. You cannot achieve anything in your life. You are a failure. You are dumb. You are useless. And it is actually this mentality of thinking that I am responsible for everything that I do, in the sense that I alone will do everything, that actually causes a lot of mental problems. When people get inferiority complex, when people get self-esteem issues, when people even become chronically depressed, they become suicidal. Why does all this happen? Because they think everything is in my power. Whatever I had set my dreams to achieve, I can achieve it. That's what they have been educated to believe. And when they can't achieve it, they think I am good for nothing. No, we may not be good for one particular thing, but we may be good for something else. So, but when we think that a society glamorizes a particular goal, and I think I have to achieve that goal, and if I can't achieve that, I'm a failure. It may well be that we may not have the set of talents and interests necessary for achieving a particular definition of success. We can succeed elsewhere. So this understanding of destiny is actually empowering. That there are certain things which are in our control and certain things which are not in our control. When we acknowledge this, then there are certain things which are in higher control beyond mine. That actually calms us down. That can help us to accept the things that are unchangeable. Now, of course, there is also... So one extreme is to think that everything is in my hands. The other extreme is to think that nothing is in my hands. That is called as fatalism. Nothing is in my hands. And many people criticize some of the Indian thought or the Vedic thought to be fatalistic. But actually, fatalism is not at all. Fatalism means that nothing is in our hands, everything is controlled by destiny, therefore we are powerless. Now that is not at all the bhakti understanding. In the same pastime, if you see, at least till the place where we have come, destiny has been referred to several times. Let's look at the reference to destiny. It has occurred thrice now. And here also, and the Maharaj in the next verse will refer to destiny. He'll say that, oh, all this has happened because of destiny. And we are all controlled by destiny. So basically we are all controlled by destiny. Nunam ya adrishta nishtoyam adrishta paramojanaha. Adrishta paramojanaha. That which is invisible, which we can't see, that controls us. So the first occurrence of destiny, in a very focused way, comes in the conversation between Vasudev and Devaki. Sorry, Vasudev and Kamsa. So Vasudev is trying out various ways to dissuade Kamsa from killing Devaki. Now, Vasudev doesn't want bloodshed on a marriage. And that's why he doesn't want to use arms to try to fight Kamsa. Kamsa, of course, is much more powerful. Although Vasudev is also heroic, at that point he's surrounded by... marriage usually happens at the girl's place. And at that time, the number of people from the girl's side are much more. So all the warriors there are on the Kamsa's side. So he doesn't want a messy bloodshed over there. So he's trying various means to protect Devaki. And one of the lines of argument he uses is, oh Kamsa, if you are destined to die, then nobody can avoid destiny. Why do you want to do this grievous sin in order to avoid that which is not avoidable? What is the grievous sin? It's a triple sin. No, it's to actually a marriage is a sacred occasion. So to cause bloodshed at a marriage is itself bad. For a kshatriya to kill a woman, that is extremely bad. And for a man to kill his own sister, he's actually his cousin, but still like a sister. For a man to kill his own sister, that is bad. So now you are doing this triple sin, you know, killing your own sister at her marriage. Now why do you want to commit such a grievous sin for avoiding that which is unavoidable? If that is the will of destiny, it is going to happen. So now, interestingly, Vasudev doesn't turn this argument around and think that, you know, if Devaki is destined to die, why am I trying all this much to save her? He doesn't think like that. Why not? Now, why does he not use the argument of destiny to think, okay, what can I do if it is her destiny to be killed on her marriage day? What can I do about it? He doesn't think like that. Because now, destiny is never an excuse for not doing one's duty. Destiny is never an excuse for not doing one's duty. So for Vasudev, it is his duty to protect his wife. And he will use all possible means to try to protect her. He's ready to even raise weapons if necessary. But he's using here the weapons of arguments. And one argument he uses for sticking to his duty, for doing his duty, is destiny. So, on the other hand, Kamsa, by trying to kill Devaki, is actually giving up his duty. He's not just giving up his duty, he is actually going against his duty. Giving up his duty means, say, if there is two countries which are hostile to each other, and there is a border security force, there are soldiers who are protecting at the border. Then if the enemy attacks and these soldiers run away, that is giving up one's duty. But if these soldiers join the enemy soldiers and they attack their own country, that is even worse. So Kamsa is not just giving up his duty, he is going against his duty. His duty is to protect his sister, and far from protecting her, he is actually about to kill her. So to stop him from doing that, Vasudev invokes destiny. So the point is that duty and destiny, they are complementary. They are not contradictory. Duty and destiny, that means we all are always meant to do our duty. The Vedic culture, the Vedic wisdom is not destiny centered. It is duty centered. And while we are doing our duty, after doing our duty also, sometimes despite our best efforts, things just go wrong. Things just go completely out of control. We do our best, and still things become a mess. So at that time, we attribute it to destiny. It's not that a student who is studying for an exam, the student doesn't study for the exam at all. And then when the student fails, the student says, oh, it was my destiny to fail. That is not your destiny, that is your irresponsibility. So destiny is never to be invoked falsely for not doing one's responsibility. Dhritarashtra actually tries to do this in the Mahabharata when Vidura is repeatedly telling Dhritarashtra, you know, stop your wicked son Duryodhana from his terrible course of antagonizing the Pandavas. Stop him from this. Otherwise your whole dynasty will be destroyed. And at that time, when Vidura is forcefully saying like this, Dhritarashtra tries to use destiny to rationalize his actions. And he says, oh Vidura, if it is the will of Almighty Destiny that our dynasty be destroyed, then who am I, a tiny mortal, to stop the will of Almighty Destiny? And Vidura just cuts through the pretensions. And he says, oh king, destiny determines the consequences of our actions, not our actions themselves. Destiny determines the consequences of our actions, not our actions themselves. So, Dhritarashtra, whether you try to stop Duryodhana or not, that is not determined by destiny. If after your best efforts to stop him, somehow it doesn't stop and the war occurs, that is destiny. So that means, in every situation that we are in, There are certain things which are in our control. And there are a lot of things that are not in our control. So the things that are in our control, that means we are to have a duty to do certain things about it. We are meant to do those things. Now, it is said that we should not think that we are controllers. That is true, we are not the supreme controllers. The Bhagavad Gita first tells in the third chapter, 3.27, a well-known verse that Prakrite kriyamanani gunai karmani sarvasha ahankara vimudhatma kartahamiti manyate. One who thinks that I am the doer, that person is an illusion. But yet, the Bhagavad Gita concludes by Krishna telling Arjuna, vimrishyaitad asheshena yathechasi tatha kuru. Deliberate deeply and then decide and then do as you desire. Do, that means Krishna is telling Arjuna, you have to be the doer. This is 18.63, and 10 verses later, replying to Krishna, Arjuna says, Karishye vachinam tava, I will do your will. I will do your will. That means he is saying, I will be the doer. So, on one level, the Bhagavad Gita seems to be saying that if you think that you are a doer, you are an illusion. But then Krishna is telling, and Arjuna is also confirming, I will be the doer. So what does it mean? In 18.16, this contradiction is resolved where it says, Tatraivam sati kartaram atmanam kevalantuya pashyati akrta buddhitva nasa pashyati durmatihi. So it says that one who thinks that I alone am the doer, I am the sole doer, that person is an illusion. So the notion of doership is not the illusion. The notion of sole doership is the illusion. So certainly, in whatever happens in our life, there are certain things which we are meant to do. We have our duty and we are meant to do that. And in that sense, we are to be doers. But if I think that by my doing alone the results are coming, that is illusion. Now, I have my part to do things, but after I do things also, there is the higher will of destiny that determines the results. So after doing my part, when still results don't come out, that we understand as destiny. So we could put this as an equation. Karma plus daiva plus kala is equal to phala. Karma is activity. Daiva, karma is duty, we could say. Duty, daiva is destiny. And kala is time. So duty plus destiny plus time gives result. So consider the example of farming. Now, a farmer has to plow the field, has to plow the field and sow the seeds. That is the duty. Then rains coming on time in a proper quantity, that is destiny. So then the farmer has sowed the seeds, then the rains come on time, then after that, the time passes. And then after the kal gets over, then there is the phala, that is the harvest comes. So like that in our life also, there is you. Now if you see in this example of duty, destiny, time and producing result, if the destiny is not there, if rains don't come, then even if somebody does their part properly, sows the seeds, plows the field, but still rains won't come, harvest won't come. But on the other hand, if that person doesn't do their duty, then even if the rains come properly, still they will not get crops, they will simply get weeds. So what is important is that we do our duty. And then when the destiny is favorable, the results will come. So the right use of destiny is to recognize that sometimes, despite my best efforts, results may not come. So that is, I attribute to destiny and stay peaceful. I don't become too worked up. I have done my part. Srila Prabhupada writes in the first canto purport that, you know, when things are beyond human control, there is nothing to regret. When things are beyond human control, we have done our part and still things are going wrong. There's nothing to regret in that. We have done our part. But what Kamsa is doing in the second usage of destiny is Kamsa has actually killed these children. And when he says their death is the will of destiny, that is a wrong use of destiny. It is that he has violated his duty, and after violating his duty, he is attributing his wrong actions to destiny. That is wrong. So we have to do our duty, and after doing our duty, if the results don't come, then that is destiny. And this is how Nanda Maharaj uses destiny in the next verse, where he says, oh, it is because of destiny that all this happened to you. Means you are a resourceful Kshatriya, you did your part in trying to protect your family, but still this has happened. So that way, the knowledge of destiny, when we see it as complementary to duty, that can actually make us peaceful. I had done my part, and if things don't work out, that is destiny. And that way we can stay peaceful and we can stay focused. I'll conclude with one point. No. Let's conclude with one point. Anxiety and intensity are actually two sides of the same coin. In every situation that we are in, there are certain things which are out of our control. And when we dwell on them too much, when we obsess over them too much, you know, oh, why is this going wrong? Why is this going wrong? Why is this happening? What is this? Why is this happening? And what if this happens? What if this happens? The more we dwell on that which is not in our control, the more we become anxious, the more we become worried. So worry comes when we obsess over that which is not in our control. But on the other hand, in whatever situation we are in, there is something which is in our control. If we focus on that, that brings intensity. This is what I can do. Tomorrow is my exam. I don't know what is going to come in the exam. I can get worried. But if I think, okay, I have now 24 hours, let me study right now. So the same situation which can cause anxiety can also bring intensity. If we focus on that which is in our control, and the duty-centered Vedic culture enables us, encourages us, empowers us to focus on that which is in our control, and thus we can move forward being as effective as is possible in our circumstances. So to summarize, I have spoke today about the intrigue, the secrecy around Krishna's birth. So Vasudev never acknowledged or never knew that Krishna was the son of Nanda Maharaj. Sorry, Nanda Maharaj never acknowledged that Krishna was the son of Vasudev. And Gopal Champu and Sararatha Darshini, Yuga Goswami and Vishnu Chakravarti's works, they describe a whole narrative by which how there is Vasudev, Krishna and Vrindavan Krishna. And Nanda Maharaj always thinks that Krishna is my son. And that's how the Puranic statement that Krishna never leaves Vrindavan, that is explained to be true, that Vrindavan, Krishna never leaves Vrindavan. And then I discussed about destiny, that destiny is, to not acknowledge destiny is to disempower ourselves. Because when things go wrong beyond our control, rather than thinking that it's because of destiny, we start imagining that I am good for nothing. On the other hand, to attribute everything to destiny, that becomes a big problem, because then we don't do what we can do. So fatalism is wrong, and complete self-determination is also wrong. The balance is that duty and destiny are complementary. And whatever is in our capacity, we do, and beyond that, we leave it to destiny. That's what Vasudev did. He was trying industriously to do his duty by invoking destiny. And Kamsa was actually using the destiny to rationalize his flagrant violation of duty. So duty plus destiny plus time, that leads to the fruit. And as long as we understand that destiny will play a role, but we focus on, so that which is destiny for a devotee is ultimately Krishna's will. Krishna is in control. Krishna will take care of things. If we understand that, then if we don't focus on that which is out of our control, because that causes anxiety, we focus on that which is in our control, that brings intensity. And thus we can become effective in whatever we are doing by focusing on it. Thank you very much. Are there any comments or questions? Yes, true.
Thank you. Brilliant class.
Thank you.
On this point of destiny, you may have answered a question that I was just pondering on even before I came over to the class, which is, why is it that Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada, discouraged disciples from getting into astrology? If you go through the Veda base, if you go to the correspondence, there's two letters where Prabhupada talks about astrology to disciples. And in both letters he says, don't do it, it's for the karmis, it's mundane, don't do it, okay? In those two letters. But elsewhere, in his conversations and lectures, he acknowledges, and in his books, he acknowledges the validity of the astrological science. On different occasions, he even refers to how his horoscope said that he was going to cross the ocean, and he was going to open 100 temples, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Towards the end of his life, he consulted astrologers, or he had the disciples check the astrology. And and he referred to the Bhrigu Samhita sometimes in lectures several times, you know, saying that a qualified Bhrigu reader could tell you about your past, your present, and your future. So, you know, on the one hand, he's telling the disciples in these two letters don't have anything to do with astrology, but on other occasions, he's acknowledging the validity of it. And I'm just wondering, do you think the reason is, as you were describing in your lecture, that he could understand that if devotees got their charts done and they could see their destiny, because most of us are coming from pretty lousy backgrounds, you know, that it, you know, we would get discouraged and we would think that, oh, well, what's the use? What's the hope? Look, according to my astrology, I'm destined to be this, that, and this. So why even bother to do my, why even bother to try? Because look, according to the astrology, this is what's going to happen. So why even bother? To, I'm trying to understand why it is that Prabhupada acknowledged it's a valid science, but at the same time discouraged devotees from getting into it. That's my question.
So Vaidyanatha Prabhupada in his books acknowledges astrology repeatedly, but in his letters he discourages devotees from consulting astrologers. My understanding is that there is paravidya, which is spiritual knowledge, aparavidya, which is material knowledge, which is given in the scriptures. Now, in general, the mood of the bhakti tradition has to be focused always on the upper, on the paravidya. So in the Bhagavatam says, dharma projita kaitavatra parmo nirmatsaranam satam. That give up even dharma artha kama moksha. Is focus on prema. Prema pumartho mana, as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is said to have said. So with this mood, you know, even that which is materially good is given up or is subordinated for the sake of the transcendental. And in that sense, devotees, because they are focusing on the ultimate thing, so if we are not even concerned about dharma, artha, kama, then astrology, which basically tells about dharma, artha, kama. Astrology tells about the material, largely talks about the material course of action that one is going to get in one's life. Then the devotees don't care so much for that. So in principle, bhakti is transcendental. And that's why while acknowledging the validity of material fields of knowledge, there is no necessity for taking to them. So now, that's in principle. In practice, Srila Prabhupada himself did consult astrologers. So there is actually this whole obsession with knowing the future that consumes many people. So before every decision, I want to consult an astrologer. I want to consult an astrologer. And this has today become a... It's not just astrology, there are tarot reading and so many other fields that are there by which people get consumed. And it can become a mental obsession. What is in the future? What is in the future? What is in the future? And that mental obsession can be a distraction from bhakti. So also at that time, and there were no trained devotee astrologers also. At that time, and Prabhupada talked about it. So in general, Srila Prabhupada discouraged devotees from going towards any of the fringe fields that can be connected with Krishna, that were traditionally connected with Krishna, but can now be distractions. So in order to, as you also said, that not only can be there is obsession with knowing the future, but there can also be, you know, rationalization of one's own actions by consulting some astrologers. Now, I want to do something. Suppose somebody is in a relationship and they find this relationship is not working. So they want to get out of the relationship. And they go to one astrologer, second astrologer, third astrologer, fourth astrologer. They say, no, don't break this relationship. Keep this relationship. They go on till they find an astrologer who says break the relationship. And then they use that astrologer to justify to breaking that relationship. So what happens? Often, I just saw a book. It's how to mess your life with astrology. So that's what happens. People can use astrology to rationalize what they want to do. And thus they can make a mess of their lives and attribute it to, oh, this was what my astrological chart said. So with proper philosophical understanding, since if astrology is consulted, that can be helpful. So Prabhupada's letters and Prabhupada's books, you know, whenever this becomes a hermeneutical issue, when Prabhupada has said one thing in one place, another thing in another place, then that means that Prabhupada acknowledged astrology, but he has given due caution with respect to consulting astrologers. So we should also be cautious and only consult trustworthy astrologers, possibly devotee astrologers, if at all we have to, and consult them with great, great caution. It is not so astrology can at best, it's like a weather forecast. It can tell us it's going to rain at this time or it's going to be a storm at this time, and then we can be a little more careful. But if we start over relying on astrology, then our focus can shift from practicing bhakti and serving Krishna to just knowing the future and trying to deal with future problems. So if for major decisions in one's life, like say somebody wants to get married, somebody wants to choose a career, or somebody wants to train their child in what kind of training they want to give, for such major decisions, consulting astrology is fine. And this becomes, when it comes to aparavidya, it is largely to one's discretion, whether one wants to use the aparavidya or one doesn't want. It's like Ayurveda. Now, Prabhupada himself, most of the time he took Ayurvedic treatment. But Prabhupada was pragmatic. Sometimes, once or twice, once he was in London, at that time, he had a allopathic surgical procedure done on him. So Prabhupada was not rigid about this thing. What practically works, one can do. So if for treatment Ayurveda works, well and good. If allopathy works, well and good. If naturopathy or homeopathy works, whatever works, that's good. So with respect to functioning in this world, astrology can serve as a tool. And if we find, can serve as a tool for functioning in this world. And if we find that it helps us, we can use it. But if we find that it just obsesses us too much, and then it distracts us from future, or it becomes a rationalization for us, then that pitfall is definitely there. And that's all the more so because now astrology has become highly commercialized. And because of that, see, it's one thing to read the charts. But it's not just reading the charts, it's actually, the charts have to, there is an objective aspect to astrology and there's a subjective aspect. Objective is okay, based on this star is like this, this star is like this, this star is like this. That's objective. But it requires experience to take those objective observations and to explain what it means. Just like, you know, from the symptoms, even a doctor, person who's just 1 year old doctor, that can say, okay, this is your disease. But if there is a 25-year-old experienced doctor, that person has a much broader perspective. And that person can tell much better, okay, this is a disease, but it's not likely to grow, or this is likely to grow. So so there is the aspect of experience also which matters. And that experience is not just being in the profession of astrology, but it's also the way one conducts oneself as astrologer, the way one lives, whether one is sattva-guna, rajoguna, tamoguna. So the competence of astrologers is also questionable. And that's why we're not saying that all astrologers are bad, but the competence is questionable, is debatable rather, and therefore one has to be very cautious when consulting astrology. So I'll say that the two ways we can, two kinds of statements of Prabhupada, I can say summarizes three things that, you know, there has to be definitely caution while consulting astrologers, and then it's up to individual discretion whether one wants to consult astrologers or not. And broadly, it's a aparadharma, and those who are practicing paradharma, they needn't have to stick to the aparadharma. But whether they want to or not, that's up to individual. Does it address the question? Any corrections or comments on this? Okay. Okay. Yes, Prabhu. Okay, fine. Yes, Prabhu. Do we have time? Yeah, please. Yeah. Yeah.
But this morning you quoted that verse in the third chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, prophet say, pretty behind the night, that the world is very so under the influence of the three modes of material nature. He thinks himself the doer, which I interpret as I understand to mean he thinks he's making choices, but in actuality, these activities are carried out by the three modes of material nature. So my question is this, okay, so I'm in total agreement that when you're asleep, it's like watching a movie, but if it's in that verse, I get the impression that even when you're awake, if you're not under the influence of the internal energy, if you're under the influence of the three modes of material nature, as described in that verse, you're also just watching a movie. Only you don't even really know. Now, there's the people in our devotees who are not actually
Okay. Under
Krishna and under the influence of the internal energy.
Okay, yeah, innocent.
They think they're making good choices, but they're just watching a movie.
Okay, yeah. Yeah. So is it that when it says we are all controlled by the three modes, to think that I am the doer is an illusion? So the doers, for non-devotees, it is the modes that are making them do things, and they are simply an illusion thinking that they are doing it? Or are they actually making choices? See, the modes push us to act in certain ways. But we have the capacity to counter-push, to resist. And the intelligence to counter-push, the inner strength to counter-push, that is enhanced by bhakti practice. But the inherent capacity is there. And that's why we can see sometimes, say somebody is an alcoholic, and then they make a resolution, you know, because of whatever reason, that I'm going to give up alcohol. But most of the times people fail, but there are some occasions when people do succeed. So philosophically speaking, Vishwanathachakra Thakur explains in the 14th chapter of the Gita, that is on the three modes, in his commentary, that actually the three modes pull us in different directions. So there's like an internal competition also between the modes. Rajas tamas cha abhibhuya sattvam bhavati bharata, rajas sattvam tamas chaiva tamas sattvam jasta. Sometimes goodness becomes prominent, sometimes passion becomes prominent, sometimes ignorance becomes prominent. So for materialistic people, their scope of choice does not extend beyond the modes. They don't know anything transcendental, so they cannot choose anything beyond the three modes. But they can at times choose among the modes. So, like somebody can choose ignorance, somebody can choose passion, somebody can choose goodness. So, for example, a student is studying for an exam. If that student goes and decides, I'll study on my bed, I lies down on the bed, then the student most likely to go to sleep. If the same student goes to a library and sits over there, everybody else is studying over there, that may inspire the student to study also. So, in the 11th canto in the Uddhav Gita, there's a list of factors that are given which shape the modes that influence us. So our sangha, our association, our diet, our normal objects of thought, our profession, like that, around 10 to 12 factors are given, which, now none of these are spiritual factors, they are material factors. They can also be spiritualized, but just as a person who is alcoholic, if that person decides not to hang out with alcoholics, starts hanging out with sober people, the likelihood of giving alcohol becomes more. So, now we could go deeper and say that ultimately that person is choosing that also based on the modes only. It's possible, but actually we do have free will. And for example, now we have, this is from the analytical perspective, from the Vedic perspective, there are even karmakanda rituals. And karmakanda rituals means, okay, you have done this sin, now you should do this atonement to give up the sin. And Baldev Vidya Bhushan, in his Vedanta Sutra commentary in the Govinda Bhashya, he explains that actually, there is a traditional school of thought which is called as Swabhavavad. Swabhavavad means we are simply products of our Swabhava. We cannot do anything which is opposed to what our body-mind is programmed to do. But he says this is not true because the scriptures tell us, do this and don't do this. If we were absolutely controlled creatures, then scripture would have no point in telling do this or don't do this. Because we would not have the capacity to choose. So this is not just for bhakti scriptures, even for karmakanda scriptures, they tell don't do this, or if you have done this, atone by doing this. That means we have choices. And the extent we choose, that is the extent to which, and the way we choose, that is up to us. So normally the way we use our free will, that either expands the scope of our free will or that decreases the scope of our free will. So for example, if a person is drinking, and the person becomes an alcohol addict, and that person can't choose whether I should drink or not. That person may be able to choose, should I drink a whiskey or a brandy? So, the scope of the free will has become very reduced. So, when people are addicted, their free will becomes very reduced, but the free will itself is never taken away. Free will is there. The scope can become more and more and more reduced. Or, by proper use, the scope can become more and more expanded. And that's how there is some free will, but not entirely free will. Can we continue personally after the class? So, thank you very much. Granthra Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Shila Prabhupada ki, Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki, Itai Gaur Premanande.
Sounds like Raja from the Shama understand. So, intention to be in this mode as opposed to that mode. We can't be in the mode of goodness, rather. Goodness, right? But it's all within the mode. Is that correct so far?
See. Material or non-devotee, material nature is not choice.
Is it absolute?
Yeah, material nature is absolute. But material nature also offers choices. No choice is not absolute.